So we are in Deuteronomy chapter 25. Thank you, Landon, for reading. Kaufman sort of gives an overview. Says that this chapter is broken into six paragraphs in the Hebrew. And he summarizes these. The first is the limiting the infliction of corporal punishment as a legal penalty. Then we have muzzling the ox on the threshing floor, just one brief verse there. And then rules regarding levirate marriage, which I think will probably be a lot of our discussion. And then he tactfully says a special law regarding wrestling. And then the law against crooked weights and measures, being dishonest in economic trading issues. And then this call for the extermination of the Amalekites. Okay, so that's a broad overview, and we will get right into it. So the first question, why was there a limit on how many blows a man could receive for a crime, Taylor?
Well, I think the short answer to this is probably to prevent cruelty and ultimately death by this punishment. These were blows, depending on who you read, either on the back or on the shoulders, or the back or shoulders or on the feet, the bastinado. 2 Samuel 7:14 talks about it being on the back and with a rod. So that's presumably what's in view here, and perhaps later on whips. Certainly whips were used by the Romans, but it seems like there's used as well later on. But the point of the limit for blows was that this wasn't to be at the whim of a human judge and his passions, overzealousness. There was latitude, it seems, for how many lashes to give someone, depending on the severity of the crime, but the max was 40. We know from elsewhere in the Bible that 40 is often used as a number of biblical fullness. So that's to be the full measure of this punishment. It was also to be done in the presence of the judge, of the judge, to again prevent abuse, have someone else watching to make sure that this wasn't overdone. And we know that the Jews often stopped at 39. They took this limit very seriously and were sure not to exceed it. 2 Corinthians 11, verse 24, Paul talks about that. And so the idea is, I think, within this section, 40 stripes is to be the max. And if 40 stripes is not a severe enough punishment, the next step up in the Mosaic law was death. So if someone was to, exceed the purview of this punishment, death awaited them. Proverbs 19, 29 also talks about being struck with a rod or stick. So presumably, again, that's what's in view within this section. And as it compared to other cultures of the day, and even in recent times, this was often a very severe punishment. No real oversight, no real limits on the extent to it, and oftentimes people did die. I thought it was interesting too, one last thing. The Jewish writer Maimonides says that later on the Jews used whips with multiple tails. And so each of those tails counted, according to the way the Jews figured it, as a lash. And so according to him at least, a three-tailed whip was common. And so that's part of the reason why 39 was often used, because then you could get 13, but you couldn't do 14, because then you would go over.
Interesting. I did see one commentator, you mentioned this 40 was a maximum, and verse 2 says a certain number of blows, so it could be less than 40. But one of the commentators, I didn't know who, said there's no record where any Jewish judge ever assigned fewer than the maximum. So we don't have that sort of mercy being shown. Other comments?
I just point out the fact, and I appreciate what Taylor said, 40 is a number that's often used. It's a time of testing or judgment and separation of the Bible, so it kind of fits with it being punishment. 40 days of rain for the flood. Moses spent 40 years in the desert. The Israelites spent 40 years in the desert. Jonah warned Nineveh for yet 40 days. Jesus spent 40 days in the wilderness being tempted, and then there were 40 years between the crucifixion and destruction of Jerusalem.
Any other thoughts? One thing that I read also was that later some judges would abuse these rules by charging someone of multiple crimes and then giving them 40 lashings for each of those crimes, and often the victim would, or the person who was charged with, would die from this excess, but they deemed that they were still following the laws because it was 40 or fewer for each crime. Okay, question number two. How is this expression used by Paul in 1 Corinthians 9:9 and 1 Timothy 5:18 referring to the expression, you shall not muzzle an ox while it treads out the grain? Logan?
So in this chapter, this verse is used to simply say, don't prevent the ox from eating while it's working on the grain. So for 1 Corinthians 9 through 12, chapter 9, 9 through 12, I was kind of grasping at straws when I read this myself, but luckily during our study tonight, that helped elucidate that this was about the apostles and their congregations and how they're deserving of support for doing the work of the Lord. And as for 1 Timothy chapter 5, 17 and 18, it's speaking about how the laborer deserves his wages for working, basically.
Thank you. Yeah.
We've seen scattered throughout Deuteronomy so far, there's commandments that have meaning, have spiritual meaning, and there are, but they also have meaning in taking care of the things that God has given the Israelites, mainly living things, things like the land, their plants, trees, animals, not to elevate these things to the status of humankind, of the Israelites, but to say that God has blessed these things with life. He's given them to you to enjoy, to use for your practicality, and you should take care of them. This is just one of those things. You let the ox eat while he grinds your grain up for you.
Other than comments, Taylor.
Yeah, to go off something Logan said, I think this is, we see it a couple times in this chapter, I think more of a principle is at play here than a specific command, like Matt said. Obviously, Israelites were to follow verse 4, but this would also have application to laborers being fair and paying someone for the work that they do. So again, there's a law specifically given, but the principle is there within the law that Israel is to apply in whatever relationship or situation they might find themselves in.
Other thoughts? When Paul uses this verse in 1 Corinthians 9, he says something, if we read the following verse, 1 Corinthians 9, verse 10, something that we can keep in mind when we do these Old Testament studies and we're going over all of this minutiae and these extreme rules and all these contingency plans for things that will never happen to us. He says in verse 10, well, reading verse 9 as well, it is written in the law of Moses, you shall not muzzle an ox while it treads out the grain. Is it oxen God's concerned about? Or does he say it altogether for our sakes? For our sakes, no doubt, this is written. And so on. And so we can keep that in mind. These things in the Old Testament are written for our sakes, and it's worth studying these and trying to understand what's being said. Any other thoughts on question 2? Okay, question number 3. What new information is provided here concerning levirate marriage? Verses 5 through 10, Sean?
Before we get to the new, let's just remind ourselves a little bit of this concept that we've studied in the past. It's called levirate marriage because of the Latin levir, which means brother-in-law. And basically, the situation, the case law, was that you have brothers living together, and one of them who is married dies without a son. Living together probably is intended to mean that the brothers lived in the same household or the same, more likely the same family land, the portion that was given to their family as an inheritance. And so the potential of merging two inheritances, for example, would be fairly simple. The law here does not discuss the marital status of the brother. I think in previous studies, we've assumed, based on various passages, that he was unmarried, and so he was an available bachelor in most cases. The widow here was not to marry outside the family, and that was presumably to keep the family land intact. However, the main reason for the arrangement was so that the name of the dead brother would not be blotted out from Israel. We've talked about the blessing of levirate marriage for the widow in that it protected her from a potential life of destitution. But really, the purpose statement for levirate marriage is given to us in this paragraph. It's so the man who dies would not be blotted out of Israel. This expression, blotted out of Israel, which is a theme in this chapter, is often used as an expression of a curse, as it is at the end of the chapter to talk about the Amalekites. They were to be blotted out entirely so that there was no remainder or memory of them. Memorial in the Old Testament is good. Being erased, being blotted out is always bad. And this will come into play too in our next question when we talk about the wrestling match. Obviously, we know the book of Ruth illustrates this concept. It's not entirely analogous because Boaz was not a brother to Ruth's deceased husband, but he was the nearest relative who was able to fulfill the obligation. So the book of Ruth gives us a real-to-life application. Now, what we have here that is new starts in verse 7, and that is that the brother could refuse for whatever reason. We're not given what a list of acceptable reasons might be. This happens also in the book of Ruth, that a nearer kinsman refuses. Maybe if he's married, he refuses, or if there's some issue with the inheritance, we don't really know, but for some reason he could refuse. And if that happens, the widow is to go to the elders at the town gate, that's where business was conducted, and report what was happening. This matter would become a community affair, and the community leaders would become involved. The elders were to investigate. And if the man persisted in refusing, there was a little ceremony to denote that this man was not going to be able to fulfill his obligation, the removal of a sandal, and she is to spit in his face. This is obviously an act of shame. It's a shameful thing that he not fulfilled the obligation to his brother and to fulfill this marital custom. So much shame, in fact, that his family will be labeled the family of the unsandaled. It was a moniker of sort that would show the public disgrace being placed upon his house. The law, of course, here demonstrates Deuteronomy's strong concern for the family, God's concern for widows and their protection, and of great significance throughout the law, the continuation of a familial line. Heirs and descendants, the importance of that goes all the way back to Abraham when the nation began. A promise of a son was the first promise of the nation. And so that idea carries on very strongly throughout the law and into the wisdom literature and the prophets. Not being able to produce an heir was with a serious matter of shame and disgrace. Blot being blotted out was a very, very severe punishment.
Okay, thank you. Matt.
I'm going to pose a question that I don't have an answer to, and I'm hoping somebody has at least some bit of information that they can glean off of this. So in Leviticus chapter 20, verse 21, if a man takes his brother's wife, it's an unclean thing. He has uncovered his brother's nakedness. They shall be childless. And in this scenario, it's for the exact opposite. It's to produce an heir. So is this scenario, or what's the difference in these scenarios, I guess would be the question. Is this the only time that it's permissible? Or are these completely different scenarios in these two, and they're unrelated? Maybe someone has an answer to that. I don't.
I don't have any answers, but I would guess that in Leviticus it is a living brother, is what my assumption would be, and that it's a brother has stolen his living brother's wife. Here in Deuteronomy, it's that the brother has died and now this wife is widowed. I would guess that's the difference, but if someone else has thoughts on that, Sean.
Most of the crimes in Leviticus 20 are crimes of fornication. Leviticus 20:21, the verse that Matt mentioned, we know can't be adultery, because we know the punishment for adultery was being stoned to death, was a capital offense. So I think Leviticus 20:21 is that a man is married and the marriage ends and she goes and marries his brother. As you said, well, he's still alive. It's probably not adultery, but for some reason, the law forbade such a thing, forbade a divorced woman from marrying her ex's brother. I think that's probably the difference in the scenario in Leviticus 20.
Yeah, I think it's important to point out in verse 5, what we see in the New King James, it says that if brothers dwell together and one of them dies and has no son. And so that's rendered son. Josephus and other Jewish writers take this and took this to include daughters as well. And I think that fits with what we saw in Numbers 27, verse 4, inheritance rules for female heirs. On Matthew 22:25, when the question is posed to Jesus of the seven marriages, that's a gender-neutral section. So I think that's what's in view here of a couple that for whatever reason is barren, and then the husband dies, and then they have an opportunity to raise up heirs. And to what Shai said earlier, it shows the importance of children in the Israelite culture, ancient culture in general, not just for preserving the family in a practical sense of farming and maintaining the land, but to keep that lineage and legacy going. And it made me think something I've thought of before in thinking about, you know, raising up heirs and the importance of that inheritance in Israel. Obviously today we're not commanded under the law of Christ to raise up necessarily children, physical heirs. But I think we do have an obligation to raise up spiritual heirs, to put a spiritual inheritance that will maintain itself after we're gone. And so I think that's something all of us maybe should think about a little bit, what we should leave behind, our spiritual legacy. Obviously, Israel was to have one, each family was to have one, so that that memory, that family would continue. And I think we're to be the same way in this day and age, so that in our case, it's the church, ultimately, to preserve it for future generations.
Yeah, I think that's a really good way to look at it.
Yeah, I appreciate Taylor's point. I think maybe it was the second point about the word son. The King James Version actually uses child, and I think it was the American Standard Version also uses child. This idea of taking on the dead brother's wife, I mean, this. I read that this practice existed among the Hittites, the Assyrians, the nation, the country of India, Africa. This was a long-standing, even South America. I mean, this was something that had went on for quite some time. So I found myself thinking about this brother that refuses to marry his dead brother's, or to take on his dead brother's wife. And why would he be of that disposition? And I guess maybe the idea of he's out of the picture, I've got control of that piece of land as well, maybe. I just thought, just wondered about it.
Yeah. Could be. Any other thoughts on this question? Some commentators make an issue about part of this ceremony, the unsandaling ceremony, is spitting in the face of this brother. And I read this lengthy discussion about some people think that means spitting to his face, meaning spitting on the ground in front of him, going and standing in front of him, and then spit on the ground. And others say, no, this is spitting in his face. And there's a big discussion about, well, why isn't it called the house of the man who was spat upon? And so the sandals were the bigger issue. I don't have an opinion on that either way. I think it says spit in his face, and that seems like due punishment. Okay, question number 4. What makes this punishment unique in the law of Moses, referring to verses 11 and 12? Bill?
Kind of interesting to think about it, and it's kind of difficult for me to answer. So this is one of the only. This is the only example that God has given for mutilation. I guess maybe you could think about circumcision, but this is the cutting off of this woman's hand. I mean. Mutilation to that kind of extent. That phrase seizes him by. I read that it carries the idea of destroying the man's ability to produce offspring, and it was suggested that this might explain the severity of the punishment for the woman. the man can no longer have a family, and so she's going to be punished severely, and I should probably leave it at that.
Okay. Yeah, boy. It's interesting that all the commentators says this is the only instance of mutilation, but I mean, if we go back to Leviticus, we have Leviticus 24:19-20, you know, it's often talked about. If a man causes disfigurement of his neighbor as he has done, so shall be done to him. Fracture for fracture, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. So, you know, it goes on. So this seems to be, there seems to be other places where there's mutilation. This is the only place where there is substitution for mutilation.
Right. And I read a bit about why some people discount that eye for an eye, tooth for tooth, and they treat it as figurative, and that the punishment should be proportional to the crime, but maybe not exactly the crime. But the other interesting part, I'm trying to say this politely, but if a judge was to adhere to that eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, there's no appropriate way to punish a woman in this situation. And so the hand was deemed equivalent, possibly. But that's all speculation. Taylor?
Couple things on this that I thought were kind of interesting. This is a very specific case that's given, so I think this is one aspect within this chapter that's meant to be typical of this sort of case, sort of like the axe head death in Deuteronomy 19, verse 5. Hopefully this didn't happen very often, what we see here, but there could be other situations, injuries caused by a foot, by a weapon, another instrument. So I think that's what it's getting at, to what's been said earlier, that this sort of effect on a person of as we see it connect to the preceding section, making it difficult or impossible for someone to raise up offspring. And there is disagreement over whether this is to be an actual dismemberment, or as you said, referring to the eye for an eye principle that is used as a proportional punishment to the crime. So the Talmud takes this passage to indicate a paying of a fine in proportion to what was done, either not literal dismemberment. In Matthew 5, verse 30, Jesus gives a very similar a phrase when he talks about if your hand causes you to sin, you should cut it off. It's better to enter heaven without a hand. Certainly, all of us, I would imagine, have sinned with our hands at one time or another, but none of us have cut them off. So there is an interesting debate to be had as to whether or not there was an actual dismemberment. Maybe so. It's compounded by the fact that the word for hand in verse 12 is not the same as in verse 11. It can have a variety of meanings. It can refer to the hand, the foot, to the hip, even. And so again, maybe that's because however you injured someone, that was to be the punishment, if it was a physical repercussion, or if it was to be as a fine in kind to the damage that was done. It's an interesting debate, but I really don't know. And I don't think this was ever actually reported in scriptures being done. So it's academic at some point. Mm-hmm.
I want to give the alternative viewpoint to the traditional interpretation of this, and it follows what Taylor was just saying, that this word calf is different than it says if a woman reaches out her hand. Yod is that, and calf is what is to be cut off. And I found a source online. This is not my idea. Shai and I talked about it. He may want to disagree with me here in a minute. But I don't like this idea of mutilation because, as we've noted, lex talionis is a principle of the punishment must fit the crime. And we don't have anywhere aside from this that says gouge the guy's eye out. So to me, this stands out as an extraordinary event. Sort of like Jephthah's daughter. We've had that discussion in the past year. But, you know, sacrificing someone to God physically is something that's not found in Scripture, and yet it seems to teach that in Judges 11 and 12, that's what happened. But if you read it carefully and you look at it carefully, it was her virginity. It was her ability to have a family, to be married, that was actually sacrificed. And so he dedicated her to God. The dad dedicated his daughter for her life to God. And I think this is a similar situation. And I admit this is a very difficult thing to look at. But the context of this wrestling match is something that was legendary to every Israelite. Every Israelite would think of Jacob wrestling with the angel. So if it was 400 years in the past, it was Jacob, the father of the 12 tribes. And if you said two men are wrestling, they'd immediately think of that. And this word, as Taylor pointed out, is used there when the angel dislocates the hip. It's the same word that's used. The word is also used in Solomon 5 to, I think, to, it's, again, it's somewhat illustrative language, but I think it's referring to a woman's genital area in the Song of Solomon chapter 5. So we have a couple references to the pelvis. And so I think what's being said here is that if a woman damages a man's fertility, his ability to reproduce, then she will be prevented from doing that in the future. So basically, she takes away a man's fertility in this act of rage or whatever, however you want to say it, by doing something that's uncalled for, then her ability to reproduce would be taken away. And it fits much better with the context because Lex Talionis says the punishment fits the crime. She took away the man's fertility. She is now not allowed in Israel to bear children. So that's something the judges and the elders would pursue. And so, you know, it's something that, if you think about what this meant to the women of that world, think about who was barren. Sarah was barren. Rebecca was barren. Rachel was barren. Samson's mother was barren. Samuel's mother, they were all barren. So it's something that's stressed in the Old Testament, that being barren is not a good thing. And then those women had children, and so they were allowed not to be barren anymore. And so if a woman was to be barren in Israel, that was a terrible, terrible price to pay. I think even more so than losing your hand. I think if you went and had a discussion with the women in the ancient world, would you rather be barren the rest of your life and prevented from having children in Israel than or lose your hand? I think a lot of them are going to say, well, it was my hand. So just from my perspective, and I know this is not something that we can lock down and say for sure, like a lot of scripture, we're wrestling with it. You know, we're wrestling with this tonight. But I think at least we should consider the possibility that this has been traditionally looked at incorrectly. And there are at least some people that say that this is not physically losing her hand, it's losing her ability to reproduce. And it also fits the context of the levirate marriage, which we just considered, because that is the same idea is found in levirate marriage, having, you know, continuing your family, and she is now prevented from having it.
I want to make sure that we understand the scenario. When you read some of the commentators, they paint this picture that two men are fighting, and one is on the verge of killing the other. I mean, he's got this huge boulder. He's about to crush in the man's skull. And at the last minute, in an act of desperation, the man who's about to be killed, his wife does the only thing she knows how to sufficiently weaken the attacker to keep him from murdering her husband. And now she's going to be punished for that. I don't think that is the scenario at all. And the word that some scholars really hone in on to paint this picture is the word rescue. If two men fight together and the wife of one draws near to rescue her husband. So they say that the rescue here means save him from imminent death. The main problem with that, other than the fact that the word rescue just means deliver and has a wide range of meanings, is that in the Old Testament, self-defense was allowed and familial defense was permitted. Now, next month, Clint's going to be here for the Midmo study to tell us whether or not the New Testament teaches the same. But the Old Testament is clear. Self-defense, the preservation of life, that is something that is ingrained throughout the law. Familial defense as well. And so I don't think this woman is being punished because she is saving her husband from death. What's worse, being maimed or being murdered? Well, being murdered in the law is much, much worse. And so if she is maiming a man to stop a murder, she is stopping the worst crimes. I don't think that's what's happening here at all. You've got a couple of guys who are going, you know, fisticuffs for whatever reason, even fight, fair fight, and they're looking to settle some territorial difference or whatever, and she does something that she ought not to be doing. She gets involved. And she gets involved in a way that I think is directly, as has been pointed out, related to the theme of much of this chapter. Being blotted out. I agree with Bart, we have to put this in the context of levirate marriage. And I think the context of levirate marriage tells us what the severity of the crime was. She wasn't just looking to stop the fight, she was looking to snuff out the man's familial line. A punishment fit for the Amalekites. That's what she was trying to do. So whatever we decide the punishment is, we have to first recognize the crime was serious. This was not a triviality. This was not just a heat of the moment, and she's trying to save her husband's life. Now, I agree with you and with Lauren. I think this is an unusual application of the lex talionis, the eye for an eye concept taught in Deuteronomy and in the Law of Moses. There is no equivalent in this sense, and so this was an unusual case. Taylor's probably right too, that this was just an example of out of the ordinary scenarios where this might need to, a judge might need to adapt the tenor of the law. I don't think that mutilation for mutilation is out of the realm of possibility for eye for an eye. I think that is probably in keeping with the punishment fits the crime. So I appreciate what Bart has presented, and I think it's worthy of consideration. I'm just not convinced that there was a way to enact it, that there was a way to make sure that a woman could no longer procreate. How that was to be done, how could that be accomplished, is a difficulty for me. Taking away her right for levirate marriage, as some suggest. Well, taking away her right for levirate marriage is not a punishment on her, it's a punishment on her husband who dies. Because we just studied the purpose of levirate marriage was so that the dead husband's line could not be blotted out from Israel. So I admit the punishment situation is difficult, but I want us to make sure that we understand the crime too.
Yeah, it's definitely thought-provoking. I mean, both your position and Bart's position, they're both compelling. One thing that came to mind, probably shouldn't freestyle when I'm up here, but the law that Taylor brought up about the accent flying off, that also could be seen as a plan in place when lex talionis won't apply. You can't punish someone by accidentally throwing an axe at them. You know what I mean? And so maybe this is, in that sense, maybe it supports that stance a little more, that there are different laws that we think of as like, well, that's never going to happen. But the idea was like, if lex talionis is the main law that we're going to be able to follow in those cases, we need to think about what happens when there are accidents or when there's a difference between men and women and there are these other things that need to be put in place. Any other thoughts on this difficult passage? Okay. Question number five. Why is this sin categorized as an abomination to the Lord your God?
Okay. I could say because it says it is, but really it's about dishonesty and being honest in your dealings with your brethren and not cheating your neighbors and being upright in your dealings. It's a very prominent theme throughout the course of the Bible, really in its entirety. John the Baptist talks about it, Luke 3. Then the tax collectors also came and baptized and said to him, "Teacher, what shall we do?" And he said to them, "Collect no more than what is permitted for you." Likewise, the soldiers asked him, saying, "What shall we do?" So he said to them, "Do not intimidate anyone or accuse falsely, and be content with your wages." And it also talks about it in Leviticus 19, verse 35. "You shall do no injustice in judgment and measurement of length, weight, or volume. You shall have honest scales, honest weights, an honest ephod, and an honest hem. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt." Yeah, that's about it. And it's certainly a practice that still goes on today. I mean, it's something that people ask him off the top all the time.
Yeah, think of people thumbing the scale, right? And the butcher weighs your meat, but has his thumb on the scale so that it looks like you'll purchase more than you intended to. Matt?
This is a deviation from one of the core aspects, one of the core adjectives that we know of God, that God is perfect justice. And the deviation from one of these core values of God would certainly be an abomination. And if you're going to, if you're commanded to mimic the things that your God does for you, then this would be an absolute, a 180 from what God wants you to do. That would be why it's condemned as an abomination.
It's also a deviation from the second commandment, love your neighbor as yourself. Definitely wouldn't be loving your neighbor as yourself. And also, we're in these sections, we're talking about differentiating Israel from Canaan, and it's in Hosea 12:7. It's an interesting verse. A cunning Canaanite, deceitful scales are in his hand. He loves to oppress. So this was a practice of the Canaanites. And later on, in a lot of the minor prophets, these are given as reasons for destruction of the nation of Israel.
Verse 13 to me is kind of a really fun verse to read. The second half, in a literal sense, the verse would read, "You shall not have in your bag differing weights, a stone and a stone." I think that's kind of the principle, that wink, wink. You know, you've got one stone that you use for buying and one that you use for selling. But I have maybe some different thoughts on why this is considered such a serious sin. Obviously, as Lauren said, it breaks at least two of the Ten Commandments, just stealing as well. But this was also an insidious sin. This is the sort of sin that is very difficult to detect, certainly back then. You know, we think of sleight of hand and all the different ways you could make a dishonest measurement. But even today, you know, for most of us, we don't have measurements, weights and measurements in our home. How can we be sure how much gas we get when we go to, you know, we look at the display, but we don't really know. And so there's a regulation, there's all this that goes into it. And so it would have been especially difficult to detect back then, but it's also an extreme abuse of authority. The people who would have had these weights and measures would have presumably been people of some power. Certainly they would have been the merchant class, those in charge of economic matters within Israel. So that would have been an extreme abuse of power for them, but also for the common Israelite affected by that, to not be able to trust those who would be in charge of changing money on all those different aspects. So it would have really hurt the economy, would have hurt trust within the nation. And so, as has been said already, there are a lot of reasons I think this is such a serious sin, but ultimately God, like the final poem says, this is an abomination. Don't do it.
Okay. I'm going to take up a little bit of what Lauren was talking about in Hosea chapter 12 and verse 7. I looked at different translations for that verse, and you'll see everything from a merchant being described as a merchant, a trafficker, and a Canaanite. And I think that's where an important observation needs to be made, that the point being that the Canaanites were known to be cheaters. They were known to cheat, and that Ephraim, Israel, was taking up God's warning them about taking up these sinful practices. And we know that the Canaanites were an abomination to the Lord, and that with Israel picking up this practice, they were becoming an abomination to the Lord.
So the pulpit commentary says, rectitude and integrity in trade are here anew inculcated, which I like. I thought of James. I've been going through James in my Sunday afternoon lessons that I've given. And a lot of James, at least from my perspective, is about how we're supposed to possess certain qualities that aren't observable. And so we're supposed to be faithful and we're supposed to be loving. How do we show those things? How do other people know? How can people measure our faith? They can measure it by our works. And so here, you should have a perfect and just weight, a perfect and just measure. The religiosity that we show should be a perfect representation of what we actually feel on the inside, is how I sort of thought about this. Anything else on question 5? Okay, our last question. What did God want Israel to do to the Amalekites? Did they ever accomplish his will in this matter? Trace?
Well, as far as the Amalekites, if you look at the book of 1 Samuel, chapter 15, we can read about how God tells Samuel to tell Saul to wipe out the Amalekites. And he tells him to wipe all of them out and their livestock. And he fails to do so because he keeps King Agag alive and the sheep. And but by the end of the chapter, Samuel kills King Agag, and And then it's God says he regrets ever making Saul king. So that's what I get.
Okay, thank you. Other comments? Taylor?
Yeah, I had forgotten how weird the history of the Amalekites is in the Bible. Because, yeah, if you read 1 Samuel 15, it seemed like they're all gone. But we know that some did persist. Some Amalekites survived at least until the time of David, famously raided Ziklag in 1 Samuel chapter 30. And then, perhaps even further, the last mention of Amalek in Scripture is in 1 Chronicles 4, verse 43, as a living force. It's mentioned in the Psalms as well. But there it talks about, I think, men of Simeon who rose up and defeated it. It seems to indicate that it was the last of the Amalekites. But again, there's never really a clear ending. And Haman of the book of Esther may have been a descendant of Agag. There's a little bit of debate on that. In Esther 3, verse 1, it says he's an Agagite or something to that extent. But that's unclear as to whether that was actually Agag or not. But regardless, as Trey said, this first assault was in 1 Samuel 15. Amalekites never really fully recovered the amount of power they had, especially once David was through with them. And this section seems to be in reference to the events of Exodus 17, verses 8 to 14, or perhaps another attack even that we're not told of. But they're commanded in Deuteronomy 25 to carry out what was given in Exodus 17, verse 14. And one thing, just to sort of end this chapter maybe a little bit, within this chapter there are lots of laws of brotherly love. We kind of touched on this throughout, given to love the laborer, love not to abuse the punishment, to use fair wage with your brother. But in this end, Israel's commanded to have no love for the enemies of God. So the Canaanites will certainly be destroyed, and Amalek, who was outside of Canaan, was also to face that judgment. And it's, I think, very telling that verses 17 to 19 are sort of sandwiched. Verse 17 begins with remember, and then verse 19 ends with you shall not forget. So this is a very extreme directive given to Israel to carry this out. And it took a long time, but it seems like they eventually did.
Yeah, I made the same observation. I know the chapter headings are added by men, but the chapter heading in the Pew Bibles, chapter 25, is Laws of Social Responsibility. And all of those seem to fit. And then the Shrine of Amalekites, is that potentially also a law of social responsibility?
Maybe a law of brotherly responsibility is better, because according to Genesis 36:12, the Amalekites were related to Israel through Esau. Amalek was the son of Eliphaz and the grandson of Esau. So these were not Canaanites. These were their distant kin. But because they had left the faith of God and gone into idolatry and then later assaulted and attacked Israel, God had decreed that they must be punished. He had judged them guilty. And so Israel was his instrument to carry out this punishment. So maybe brotherly interactions is a better header for the chapter.